That was when the coldness started to come in, though. That afternoon in the garden. And when the first crack in the wall families put between themselves and the rest of the world showed up between us. Since then, it's only gotten wider and wider. She calls me twice a month. She's good about that. But we're apart just the same. We are estranged. What I did was mostly done for Selina, not for the boys or because of the money her dad tried to steal. It was mostly for Selina that I led him on to his death. And all it cost me to protect her from him was the deepest part of her love for me. I once heard my own dad say that God pitched a bitch on the day he made the world. And over the years, I've come to understand what he meant. And you know the worst of it. Sometimes it's funny. Sometimes it's so funny you can't help from laughing, even while it's all fallen apart around you. Meantime, Garrett Thibodeau and his barbershop cronies kept busy not finding Joe. It had gotten to the point where I thought I'd just have to stumble on him myself, as little as I liked the idea. If it hadn't been for the dough, I'd have been happy to leave him down there until the last trump blew. But the money was over there in Jonesport, sitting in a bank account with his name on it, and I didn't fancy waiting 7 years to have him declared legally dead so I could get it back. Selina was going to be starting college in just a little over 2 years, and she'd want some of that money to get herself going. The idea that Joe might have taken his bottle into the woods behind the house and either stepped in a trap or taken a fall walking home tipsy in the dark finally started to go the rounds. Garrett claimed it was his idea, but that's awful hard for me to believe, having gone to school with him like they did. He put a sign-up sheet on the door of the town hall Thursday afternoon, and on Saturday morning, a week after the eclipse this was, he fielded a search party of 40 or 50 men. They formed up a line by the east head end of Highgate Woods and worked their way toward the house, first through the woods and then across Russian Meadow. I seen them crossing the meadow in a long line around 1 o'clock, laughing and joking. But the joking stopped, and the cursing begun when they crossed over onto our property and got into the blackberry tangle. I stood in the entry door, watching them come with my heart beating way up in my throat. I remember thinking that at least Selina weren't home. She'd gone over to see Laurie Langle, and that was a blessing. Then I started thinking that all those brambles would cause them to just say frigate and break off the search before they got anywhere near the old well. But they kept on coming. All at once I heard Sonny Benoit scream, "Hey, Garrett, over here! Get over here!" And I knew that, for better or worse, Joe had been found. There was an autopsy, of course. They did it the very day they found him. And I guess it might have still been going on when Jack and Alicia Forbert brought the boys back around dusk. Pete was crying, but he looked all confused. I don't think he really understood what had happened to his dad. Joe Jr. did, though. And when he drew me aside, I thought he was going to ask me the same question Selina had asked. And I steeled myself to tell the same lie. But he asked me something entirely different. "Ma," he says, "if I was glad he was dead, would God send me to hell?" "Joey, a person can't much help his feelings, and I think God knows that," I said. Then he started to cry, and he said something that broke my heart. "I tried to love him," is what he told me. "I always tried, but he wouldn't let me." I swept him into my arms and hugged him as hard as I could. I think that was about as close as I come to crying in the whole business. But of course you have to remember that I hadn't been sleeping too well and still hadn't the slightest idea of how things was going to play out. There was to be an inquest on Tuesday, and Lucien Mercier, who ran the only mortuary on Little Tall back then, told me I'd finally be allowed to bury Joe in the Oaks on Wednesday. But on Monday, the day before the inquest, Garrett called me on the telephone and asked if I could come down to his office for a few minutes. It was the call I'd been expecting and dreading, but there wasn't nothing to do but go. So I asked Alicia if she'd keep an eye on the kids, and then I went. Garrett wasn't alone. Dr. John McAuliffe was with him, I'd more or less expected that, too, but my heart still sank a little in my breast. McAuliffe was the county medical examiner back then. He died 3 years later when a snowplow hit his little Volkswagen Beetle. It was Henry Bryerton took over the job when McAuliffe died. If Bryerton had been the county man in 63, I'd have felt a good deal easier in my mind about our little talk that day. Bryerton's smarter than poor old Garrett Thibodeau was, but only by a horsehair or so. John McAuliffe, though, he had a mind like the lamp that shines out a Vatican light. He was a genuine bottled-in bond Scotsman who turned up in these parts right after World War II ended, hootmon, burr and all. I guess he must have been an American citizen, since he was both doctoring and holding a county position, but he sure didn't sound much like folks from around here. Not that it mattered to me. I knew I'd have to face him down, no matter if he was an American or a Scotsman or a heathen Chinee. He had snowy white hair, even though he couldn't have been more than 45, and blue eyes so bright and sharp, they looked like drill bits. When he looked at you, you felt like he was staring right into your head and putting the thoughts he saw there into alphabetical order. As soon as I seen him sitting beside Garrett's desk and heard the door to the rest of the town office building click closed behind me, I knew that what happened the next day over on the mainland didn't matter at Tinker's Dam. The real inquest was going to happen right there, in that tiny town constable's office, with a Weber oil calendar hanging on one wall and a picture of Garrett's mother hanging on another. "I'm sorry to bother you in your time of grief, Dolores," Garrett said. He was rubbing his hands together, kind of nervous, and he reminded me of Mr. Pease over at the bank. Garrett must have had a few more calluses on his hands, though, because the sound they made going back and forth was like fine sandpaper rubbing along a dry board. "But Dr. McAuliffe here has a few questions he'd like to ask you." I seen by the puzzled way Garrett looked at the doc that he didn't know what those questions might be, though, and that scared me even more. I didn't like the idea of that canny Scotsman thinking matters were serious enough for him to keep his own counsels and not give poor old Garrett Thibodeau any chance at all to frig up the works. "My deepest sympathies, Mrs. St. George," McAuliffe says in that thick Scots accent of his. He was a little man, but compact and well put together for all that. He had a neat little mustache, as white as the hair on his head. He was wearing a three-piece wool suit, and he didn't look no more like home folks than he sounded like them. Those blue eyes went drilling away at my forehead, and I seen he didn't have a bit of sympathy for me, no matter what he was saying. Probably not for nobody else either, including himself. "I'm very, very sorry for your grief and misfortune." "Sure, and if I believe that, you'll tell me one more," I thought. "The last time you was really sorry, Doc, was the last time you needed to use the paid toilet and the string on your pet dime broke." But I made up my mind right then that I wasn't going to show him how scared I was. Maybe he had me and maybe he didn't. You got to remember that for all I knew, he was going to tell me that when they laid Joe on the table there in the basement of County Hospital and opened his hands, a little piece of white nylon fell out of one. A scrid of a lady's slip. That could be, all right. But I still wasn't going to give him the satisfaction of squirming under his eyes. And he was used to having people squirm when he looked at him. He'd come to take it as his due. And he liked it. "Thank you very much," I said. "Will you sit down, madam?" he asks. Like it was his office, instead of poor old confused Garrett's. I sat down, and he asked me if I'd kindly give him permission to smoke. I told him the lamp was lit as far as I was concerned. He chuckled like I'd made a funny, but his eyes didn't chuckle. He took a big old black pipe out of his coat pocket, a briar, and stoked it up. His eyes never left me while he was doing it either. Even after he had it clamped between his teeth and the smoke was rising out of the bowl, he never took his eyes off me. They gave me the willies, peering at me through the smoke like they did, and made me think of Vatican Light again. They say that one shines out almost 2 miles, even on a night when the fog's thick enough to carve with your hands. I started to squirm under that look of his in spite of all my good intentions. And then I thought of Vera Donovan saying, "Nonsense. Husbands die every day, Dolores." It occurred to me that McAuliffe could stare at Vera until his eyes fell out and never get her to so much as cross her legs the other way. Thinking of that eased me a little, and I grew quiet again. Just folded my hands on top of my handbag and waited him out. At last, when he seen I wasn't going to fall out of my chair onto the floor and confess to murdering my husband, through a rain of tears is how he would have liked it, I imagine, he took the pipe out of his mouth and said, "You told the constable 'twas your husband who put George. Isn't that right?" "Yeah," I says. I could feel myself wanting to say something more, to explain myself, but I didn't, even though I could. That's what McAuliffe wanted, you see, for me to go on rushing ahead, to explain myself right into a jail cell someplace. At last he gave up waiting. He twiddled his fingers like he was annoyed, then fixed those lighthouse eyes of his on me again. "After the choking incident, you left your husband. You went up to Russian Meadow on the way to East Head to watch the eclipse by yourself." "Yeah." He leaned forward all of a sudden, his little hands on his little knees, and says, "Mrs. St. George, do you know what direction the wind was from that day?" It was like the day in November of 62 when I almost found the old well by falling into it. I seemed to hear the same cracking noise, and I thought, "You be careful, Dolores Claiborne. You be oh so careful. There's wells everywhere today, and this man knows where every goddamn one of 'em is." "No," I says, "I don't. And when I don't know where the wind's quartering from, that usually means the day's calm." "Actually, wasn't much more than a breeze," Garrett started to say, but McAuliffe raised his hand and cut him off like a knife blade. "It was out of the west," he said. "A west wind, a west breeze, if you so prefer. 7 to 9 miles an hour with gusts up to 15. It seems strange to me, Mrs. St. George, that the wind didn't bring your husband's cries to you as you stood in Russian Meadow, not half a mile away." I didn't say anything for at least 3 seconds. I'd made up my mind that I'd count to 3 inside my head before I answered any of his questions. Doing that might keep me from moving too quick and paying for it by falling into one of the pits he'd dug for me. But McAuliffe must have thought he had me confused from the word go, because he leaned forward in his chair, and I'll declare and vow that for 1 or 2 seconds there, his eyes went from blue hot to white hot. "It don't surprise me," I says. "For one thing, 7 miles an hour ain't much more'n a puff of air on a muggy day. For another, there were about 1,000 boats out on the reach, all tooting to each other. And how do you know he called out at all? You sure as hell didn't hear him." He sat back, looking a little disappointed. "It's a reasonable deduction to make," he says. "We know the fall itself didn't kill him, and the forensic evidence strongly suggests that he had at least one extended period of consciousness. Mrs. St. George, if you fell into a disused well and found yourself with a broken shin, a broken ankle, 4 broken ribs, and a sprained wrist, wouldn't you call for aid and succor?" I gave it 3 seconds with a My Pretty Pony between each one, and then said, "It wasn't me who fell down the well, Dr. McAuliffe. It was Joe, and he'd been drinking." "Yes," Dr. McAuliffe comes back. "You bought him a bottle of Scotch whiskey, even though everyone I've spoken to says you hated it when he drank. Even though he became unpleasant and argumentative when he drank, you bought him a bottle of Scotch. And he had not just been drinking, he was drunk. He was very drunk. His mouth was also filled with blood, and his shirt was matted with blood, all the way down to his belt buckle. When you combine the fact of this blood with a knowledge of the broken ribs and the concomitant lung injuries he had sustained, Do you know what that suggests? 1, my pretty pony. 2, my pretty pony. 3, my pretty pony. Nope, I says. Several of the fractured ribs had punctured his lungs. Such injuries always result in bleeding, but rarely bleeding this extensive. Bleeding of this sort was probably caused, I deduce, by the deceased crying repeatedly for rescue. That was how he said it, Andy. Rescue. It wasn't a question, but I counted 3 all the same before saying, "You think he was down there calling for help?" That's what it all comes to, ain't it? "No, madam," he says. "I do not just think so. I have a moral certainty." This time I didn't take no weight. "Dr. McAuliffe," I says, "do you think I pushed my husband down into that well?" That shook him up a little. Those lighthouse eyes of his not only blinked for a few seconds, but there they dulled right over. He fiddled and diddled with his pipe some more, then stuck it back in his mouth and drew on it, all the time trying to decide how he should handle that. Before he could, Garrett spoke up. His face had gone as red as a radish. "Dolores," he says, "I'm sure no one thinks, that is to say, that no one has even considered the idea that..." "Aye," McAuliffe breaks in. I'd put his train of thought off on a siding for a few seconds, but I saw he'd got it back onto the main line without no real trouble. "I've considered it. You'll understand, Mrs. St. George, that part of my job..." "Oh, never mind no more, Mrs. St. George," I says. "If you're going to accuse me of first pushing my husband down the well and then standing over him while he screamed for help, you go right on ahead and call me Dolores." I wasn't exactly trying to plink in that time, Andy, but I'll be damned if I didn't do it anyway. Second time in as many minutes. I doubt he'd been used that hard since medical school. "Nobody is accusing you of anything, Mrs. St. George," he says, all stiff-like. And what I seen in his eyes was, "Not yet, anyway." "Well, that's good," I says, "because the idea of me pushing Joe down the well is just silly, you know. He outweighed me by at least 50 pounds, probably a fairish bit more. He larded up considerable the last few years. Also, he weren't afraid to use his fists if somebody crossed him or got in his way. I'm telling you that as his wife of 16 years, and you'll probably find plenty of people on the island who'll tell you the same thing." Of course, Joe hadn't hit me in a long while, but I'd never tried to correct the general impression on the island that he made a pretty steady business of it, and right then, with McAuliffe's blue eyes trying to bore in through my forehead, I was damn glad of it. "Nobody is saying you pushed him into the well," the Scotsman said. He was backing up fast now. I could see by his face that he knew he was, but didn't have no idea how it had happened. His face said that I was the one who was supposed to be backing up. "But he must have been crying out, you know. He must have done it for some time. Hours, perhaps. And quite loudly, too." 1, my pretty pony. 2, my pretty pony. 3. "Maybe I'm getting you now," I says. "Maybe you think he fell into the well by accident, and I heard him yelling and just turned a deaf ear. Is that what you've been getting at?" I seen by his face that that was exactly what he'd been getting at. I also seen he was mad things weren't going the way he'd expected them to go, the way they'd always gone before when he had these little interviews. A tiny ball of bright red color had showed up in each of his cheeks. I was glad to see him, because I wanted him mad. A man like McAuliffe is easier to handle when he's mad, because men like him are used to keeping their composure while other people lose theirs. "Mrs. St. George, it will be very difficult to accomplish anything of value here if you keep responding to my questions with questions of your own." "Why, you didn't ask a question, Dr. McAuliffe," I says, popping my eyes wide and innocent. "You told me Joe must have been yelling. Crying out was what you actually said. So I just asked if..." "All right, all right," he says, and put his pipe down in Garrett's brass ashtray, hard enough to make it clang. Now his eyes were blazing, and he'd grown a red stripe across his forehead, to go along with the balls of color in his cheeks. Did you hear him calling for help, Mrs. St. George? One, my pretty pony. Two, my pretty pony. John, I hardly think there's any call to badger the woman. Garrett broke in, sounding more uncomfortable than ever. And damn if it didn't break that little bandbox Scotsman's concentration again. I almost laughed right out loud. It would have been bad for me if I had. I don't doubt it. But it was a near thing all the same. McAuliffe whipped around and says to Garrett, "You agreed to let me handle this." Poor old Garrett jerked back in his chair fast. He almost tipped it over. And I'm sure he gave himself a whiplash. "Okay, okay, no need to get hot under the collar," he mumbles. McAuliffe turned back to me, ready to repeat the question, but I didn't bother letting him. By then I'd had time to count to 10 pretty near. "No," I says, "I didn't hear nothing but people out on the reach, tooting their boat horns and yelling their fool heads off once they could see the eclipse had started to happen." He waited for me to say some more. His old trick of being quiet and letting people rush ahead into the pucker brush. And the silence spun out between us. I just kept my hands folded on top of my handbag and let her spin. He looked at me, and I looked back at him. "You're going to talk to me, woman," his eyes said. "You're going to tell me everything I want to hear, twice, if that's the way I want it." And my own eyes were saying back, "No, I ain't, chummy. You can sit there drilling on me with those diamond bit baby blues of yours until hell's a skating rink, and you won't get another word out of me unless you open your mouth and ask for it." We went on that way for damn near a full minute, dueling with our eyes, you might say. And toward the end of it, I could feel myself weakening, wanting to say something to him, even if it was only, "Didn't your ma ever teach you it ain't polite to stare?" Then Garrett spoke up, or rather his stomach did. It let out a long groan sound. McAuliffe looked at him, disgusted as hell, and Garrett got out his pocket knife and started to clean under his fingernails. McAuliffe pulled a notebook from the inside pocket of his wool coat. Wool? In July? Looked at something in it, then put it back. "He tried to climb out," he says at last, as casual as a man might say, "I've got a lunch appointment." It felt like somebody jabbed a meat fork into my lower back, where Joe hit me with a stove link that time, but I tried not to show it. "Oh, eh?" I says. "Yes," McAuliffe says. "The shaft of the well is lined with large stones," only he said stains, Andy, like they do. "And we found bloody handprints on several of them. It appears that he gained his feet, then slowly began to make his way up, hand over hand. It must have been a Herculean effort, made despite a pain more excruciating than I can imagine." "I'm sorry to hear he suffered," I said. My voice was as calm as ever. At least I think it was. But I could feel the sweat starting to break in my armpits, and I remember being scared it would spring out on my brow or in the little hollows of my temples where he could see it. "Poor old Joe." "Yes, indeed," McAuliffe says, his lighthouse eyes boring and flashing away. "Poor old Joe. I think he might have actually gotten out on his own. He probably would have died soon after, even if he had. But yes, I think he might have gotten out. Something prevented him from doing so, however." "What was it?" I asked. "He suffered a fractured skull," McAuliffe said. His eyes were as bright as ever, but his voice had become as soft as a purring cat. "We found a large rock between his legs. It was covered with your husband's blood, Mrs. St. George. And in that blood, we found a small number of porcelain fragments. Do you know what I deduce from them?" 1, 2, 3. "Sounds like that rock must have busted his false teeth as well as his head," I says. Too bad. Joe was partial to him. And I don't know how Lucian Mercier's going to make him look just right for the viewing without him. McAuliffe's lips drew back when I said that, and I got a good look at his teeth. No dentures there. I suppose he meant it to look like a smile, but it didn't, not a bit. Yes, he says, showing me both rows of his neat little teeth, all the way to the gum line. Yes, that's my conclusion as well. Those porcelain shards are from his lower plate. Now, Mrs. St. George, do you have any idea of how that rock might have come to strike your husband just as he was on the verge of escaping the well? 1, 2, 3. Nope, I says. Do you? Yes, he says. I rather suspect someone pulled it out of the earth and smashed it cruelly and with malice aforethought onto his upturned, pleading face. Wasn't nobody said anything after that. I wanted to, God knows. I wanted to jump in as quick as ever I could and say, it wasn't me. Maybe somebody did it, but it wasn't me. I couldn't, though, because I was back in the blackberry tangles, and this time there was friggin' wells every place. Instead of talking, I just sat there looking at him. But I could feel the sweat trying to break out on me again, and I could feel my clasped hands wanting to lock down on each other. The fingernails would turn white if they did that, and he'd notice. McAuliffe was a man built to notice such things. It'd be another chink to shine his version of the Bataskan light into. I tried to think of Vera and how she would have looked at him, as if he was only a little dab of dog shit on one of her shoes. But with his eyes boring into me like they was just then, it didn't seem to do any good. Before, it had been like she was almost there in the room with me. But it wasn't like that anymore. Now there was no one there but me and that neat little Scots doctor, who probably fancied himself just like the amateur detectives in the magazine stories, and whose testimony had already sent over a dozen people up and down the coast to jail, I found out later. And I could feel myself getting closer and closer to opening my mouth and blurting something out. And the hell of it was, Andy, I didn't have the slightest idea what it'd be when it finally came. I could hear the clock on Garrett's desk ticking. It had a big hollow sound. And I was going to say something when the one person I'd forgot, Garrett Thibodeau, spoke up instead. He spoke in a worried, fast voice, and I realized he couldn't stand no more of that silence either. He must have thought it was going to go on until somebody had to scream just to relieve the tension. Now, John, he says, I thought we agreed that if Joe pulled on that stone just right, it could have come out on its own, and, Mon, will you not shut up? McAuliffe yelled at him in a high, frustrated sort of voice, and I relaxed. It was all over. I knew it. And I believe that little Scotsman knew it, too. It was like the two of us had been in a black room together, and him tickling my face with what might have been a razor blade. And then clumsy old Constable Thibodeau stubbed his toe, fell against the window, and the shade went up with a bang and a rattle, letting in the daylight. And I seen it was only a feather he'd been touching me with after all. Garrett muttered something about how there was no call for McAuliffe to talk to him that way, but the doc didn't pay him no mind. He turned back to me and said, "Well, Mrs. St. George," in a hard way, like he had me in a corner. But by then we both knew better. All he could do was hope I'd make a mistake. But I had 3 kids to think about, and having kids makes you careful. "I've told you what I know," I says. "He got drunk while we were waiting for the eclipse. I made him a sandwich, thinking it might sober him up a little, but it didn't. He got yelling, then he choked me and battered me around a little, so I went up to Russian Meadow. When I come back, he was gone. I thought he'd gone off with one of his friends, but he was down the well all the time. I suppose he was trying to take a shortcut out to the road. He might even have been looking for me, wanting to apologize. That's something I won't never know. And maybe it's just as well. I give him a good hard look. You might try a little of that medicine yourself, Dr. McAuliffe. Never mind your advice, madam, McAuliffe says. And those spots of color in his cheeks were burning brighter and hotter than ever. Are you glad he's dead? Tell me that. What in holy tarnal hell has that got to do with what happened to him? I asked. Jesus Christ, what's wrong with you? He didn't answer. Just picked up his pipe in a hand that was shaking the tiniest little bit and went to work lighting it again. He never asked another question. The last question that was asked of me that day was asked by Garrett Thibodeau. McAuliffe didn't ask it because it didn't matter, at least not to him. It meant something to Garrett, though, and it meant even more to me because nothing was going to end when I walked out of the town office building that day. In some ways, me walking out was going to be just the beginning. That last question and the way I answered it mattered plenty, because it's usually the things that wouldn't mean squat in a courtroom that get whispered about the most over back fences while women hang out their wharf, or out on the lobster boats while men are sitting with their backs against the pilot house and eating their lunches. Those things may not send you to prison, but they can hang you in the eyes of the town. Why in God's name did you buy him a bottle of liquor in the first place? Garrett kind of bleated. What got into you, Dolores? I thought he'd leave me alone if he had something to drink, I said. I thought we could sit together in peace and watch the eclipse and he'd leave me alone. I didn't cry, not really, but I felt one tear go rolling down my cheek. I sometimes think that's the reason I was able to go on living on Little Tall for the next 30 years, that one single tear. If not for that, they might have driven me out with their whispering and carping and pointing at me from behind their hands. Yeah, in the end they might have. I'm tough, but I don't know if anyone's tough enough to stand up to 30 years of gossip and little anonymous notes saying things like, you got away with murder. I did get a few of those, and I got a pretty good idea of who sent them, too. Although that ain't neither here nor there at this late date. But they stopped by the time school let back in that fall. And so I guess you could say that I owe all the rest of my life, including this part here, to that single tear. And to Garrett putting the word out that in the end I hadn't been too stony-hearted to cry for Joe. There wasn't nothing calculated about it either. And don't you go thinking there was. I was thinking about how sorry I was that Joe'd suffered, the way the little bandbox Scotsman said he had. In spite of everything he'd done and how I'd come to hate him since I'd first found out what he was trying to do to Selina, I'd never intended for him to suffer. I thought the fall'd kill him. Andy, I swear on the name of God, I thought the fall'd kill him outright. Poor old Garrett Thibodeau went as red's a stop sign. He fumbled a wad of Kleenex out of the box of them on his desk and kind of groped it out at me without looking. I imagine he thought that first tear meant I was going to go a gusher and apologized for putting me through such a stressful interrogation. I bet those were just about the biggest words he knew. McAuliffe let out a humph sound at that, said something about how he'd be at the inquest to hear my statement taken, and then he left. Stalked out, actually, and slammed the door behind him hard enough to rattle the glass. Garrett gave him time to clear out, and then walked me to the door, holding my arm, but still not looking at me. He was actually sort of comical, and muttering all the time. I ain't sure what he was muttering about, but I suppose that whatever it was really Garrett's way of saying he was sorry. That man had a tender heart, and couldn't stand to see someone unhappy. I'll say that for him. And I'll say something else for Little Tall. Where else could a man like that not only be constable for almost 20 years, but get a dinner in his honor complete with a standing ovation at the end of it when he finally retired? I'll tell you what I think. a place where a tender-hearted man can succeed as an officer of the law, ain't such a bad place to spend your life. Not at all. Even so, I was never gladder to hear a door close behind me than I was when Garrett's clicked shut that day. So that was the bugger, and the inquest the next day wasn't nothing compared to it. McAuliffe asked me many of the same questions, and they were hard questions, but they didn't have no power over me anymore, and we both knew it. My one tear was all very well, but McAuliffe's questions, and the fact that everyone could see he was pissed like a bear at me, went a long way toward starting the talk which has run on the island ever since. Oh, well, there would have been some talk no matter what. Ain't that right? The verdict was death by misadventure. McAuliffe didn't like it, and at the end he read his findings in a dead, level voice without ever looking up once. But what he said was official enough. Joe fell down the well while drunk, had probably called for help for quite a while without getting an answer, then tried to climb out on his own hook. He got most of the way to the top, then put his weight on the wrong stone. It pulled free, bashed him in the head hard enough to fracture his skull, not to mention his dentures, and knocked him back down to the bottom again, where he died. Maybe the biggest thing, and I never realized this until later, was they couldn't find no motive to hang on me. Of course the people in town, and Dr. McAuliffe too, I have no doubt, thought that if I had done it, I did it to get shot of him beating me. But all by itself, that didn't carry enough weight. Only Selina and Mr. Pease knew how much motive I'd really had. And no one, not even smart old Dr. McAuliffe, thought of questioning Mr. Pease. He didn't come forward on his own hook, either. If he had of, our little talk in the chatty buoy would have come out, and he'd most likely have been in trouble with the bank. I'd talk him into breaking the rules, after all. As for Selina, well, I think Selina tried me in her own court. Every now and then I'd see her eyes on me, dark as the ocean ahead of a squall line, and in my mind I'd hear her asking, "Did you do anything to him? Did you, Mama? Is it my fault? Am I the one who has to pay?" I think she did pay. That's the worst part. The little island girl who was never out of the state of Maine until she went to Boston for a swim meet when she was 18 has become a smart, successful career woman in New York City. There was an article about her in the New York Times 2 years ago. Did you know that? She writes for all those magazines and still finds time to write me once a week. But they feel like duty letters. Just like the phone calls twice a month feel like duty calls. I think the calls and the chatty little notes are the way she pays her heart to be quiet about how she don't ever come back here, about how she's cut her ties with me. Yes, I think she paid, all right. I think the one who was the most blameless of all paid the most, and that she's paying still. She's 44 years old and has never married. She's too thin, and I think she drinks. I've heard it in her voice more than once when she calls. I got an idea that might be one of the reasons she don't come home anymore. She doesn't want me to see her drinking like her father drank. Or maybe because she's afraid of what she might say if she had one too many while I was right handy. What she might ask. But never mind. It's all water over the dam now. I got away with it. That's the important thing. If there'd been insurance, or if Pease hadn't have kept his mouth shut, I'm not sure I would have. Of the two, a fat insurance policy probably would have been worse. The last thing in God's round world I needed was some smart insurance investigator hooking up with that smart little Scots doctor, who was already mad as hell at the idea of being beaten by an ignorant island woman. Nope, if there'd been two of them, I think they might have got me. So what happened? Why, what I imagine always happens in cases like that, when a murder's been done and not found out. Life went on, that's all. Nobody popped up with last-minute information, like in a movie. I didn't try to kill nobody else, and God didn't strike me dead with a lightning bolt. Maybe he felt hitting me with lightning over the likes of Joe St. George would have been a waste of electricity. I suppose that's blasphemy, but it also feels like nothing but the truth. Life just went on. I went back to Pinewood and to Vera. Selina took up her old friendships when she went back to school that fall, and sometimes I heard her laughing on the phone. When the news finally sunk in, little Pete took it hard, and so did Joe Jr. Joey took it harder than I'd expected, actually. He lost some weight and had some nightmares. But by the next summer, he seemed mostly all right again. The only thing that really changed during the rest of 1963 was that I had Seth Reed come over and put a cement cap on the old well. 6 months after he died, Joe's estate was settled in county probate. I wasn't even there. A week or so later, I got a paper telling me that everything was mine. I could sell it or swap it or drop it in the deep blue sea. When I'd got done going through what he'd left, I thought the last of those choices looked like the best one. One kind of surprising thing I discovered, though, if your husband dies sudden, it can come in handy if all his friends were idiots, like Joe's were. I sold the old shortwave radio he'd been tinkering on for 10 years to Norris Panett for $25, and the 3 junk trucks setting in the backyard to Tommy Anderson. That fool was more'n glad to have 'em, and I used the money to buy a 59 Chevy that had wheezy valves but ran good otherwise. I also had Joe's savings passbook made over to me and reopened the kids' college accounts. Oh, and one other thing. In January of 1964, I started going by my maiden name again. I didn't make no particular fanfare about it, but I was damned if I was going to drag St. George around behind me the rest of my life like a can tied to a dog's tail. I guess you could say I cut the string holding the can. But I didn't get rid of him as easy as I got rid of his name, I can tell you that. Not that I expected to. I'm 65, and I've known for at least 50 of those years that most of what being human's about is making choices and paying the bills when they come due. Some of the choices are pretty goddamn nasty, but that don't give a person leave to just walk away from 'em, especially not if that person's got others dependent on her to do for 'em what they can't do for themselves. In a case like that, you just have to make the best choice you can and then pay the price. For me, the price was a lot of nights when I woke up in a cold sweat from bad dreams, and even more when I never got to sleep at all. That and the sound the rock made when it hit him in the face, busting his skull and his dentures. That sound, like a china plate on a brick hearth. I've heard it for 30 years. Sometimes it's what wakes me up, and sometimes it's what keeps me out of sleep. And sometimes it surprises me in broad daylight. I might be sweeping the porch at home, or polishing the silver at Vera's, or sitting down to my lunch with the TV turned to the Oprah show. And all at once I'll hear it. That sound. Or the thud when he hit bottom. Or his voice coming up out of the well. Dolores! I don't suppose those sounds I sometimes hear are so different from whatever it was that Vera really saw when she screamed about the wires in the corners or the dust bunnies under the bed. There were times, especially after she really began to fail, when I'd crawl in bed with her and hold her and think of the sound the rock made, and then close my eyes and see a china plate striking a brick hearth and shattering all to bits. When I saw that, I'd hug her like she was my sister, or like she was myself. We'd lie in that bed, each with her own fright, and finally we'd drowse off together, her with me to keep the dust bunnies away, and me with her to keep away the sound of the china plate. And sometimes, before I went to sleep, I'd think, this is how you pay off being a bitch. And it ain't no use saying if you hadn't been a bitch, you wouldn't have had to pay. Because sometimes the world makes you be a bitch. When it's all doom and dark outside and only you inside to first make a light and then tend it, you have to be a bitch. But oh, the price. The terrible price. Andy, you suppose I could have one more tiny little nip from that bottle of yours? I'll never tell a soul. Thank you. And thank you, Nancy Bannister, for putting up with such a long-winded old broad as me. How are your fingers holding out? Are they? Good. Don't lose your courage now. I've gone at it with a shins, I know, but I guess I've finally gotten around to the part you really want to hear about just the same. That's good, because it's late and I'm tired. I've been working my whole life, but I can't remember ever being as tired as I am right now.